You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Sweetwater Nanak, the director of Idle No More Washington, about culture, spirituality, social change, and how to decolonize our lives as we work to protect both people and planet.
Now I call it the corporate colonization that has continued. And it's important to know that we're all in this together, really. And together we need to decolonize in order to work together at this crucial time in our history as the Earth is changing, and that it takes all of us.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell, Kwe, Iguanu. Welcome and greetings to you in my native language. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land in Bunawabskik Territory, in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. I'm joined today, as ever, by my radiant co-host, Miss Rivera Sun, and our special guest, Miss Sweetwater Nanak. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Sherry. I'm very glad to have you back on the show after your hiatus and time away last week. We had a great conversation with Diane Patterson, and we were both sad to miss you, but it was a good show. This week, we have a guest that I've had the pleasure of speaking with before, back when we used to run Occupy Radio with David Getchi Sierra Lupe. Sweetwater Nanak is the director of Idle No More Washington, and we are just always thrilled whenever we get a chance to speak with her because she brings so much wisdom to the work that she's doing for change and so much spirit as well. And I feel like on Love and Revolution Radio, that's actually the heart of the matter that we cover. So welcome to the show, Sweetwater.
Thank you for having me here today. Sinuksin yukat duasak. Ishbiwada ayakat. Kiksari yari khatsati. Seat grade data chunk. Aslik, Yehirika, Nanya East, Akin Kwan Ayahat. My name is Sweetwater Nanak. I am from the Killiwale clan of the Tsimshian Nation. My father is from the Raven Frog clan of the Tlingit Nation. And I am the grandchild of the Glacier People clan. My great grandmother was the precious grandchild of the Upper Living People clan of the Stikine River in Alaska. So I'm grateful to be here today. I live in Washington State, and I'm the director of Idle No More Washington, doing a lot of the work for our people here in our state.
Sweetwater, it's wonderful to talk to you and to have somebody joining us today with such powerful water medicine. And I know that you have been working, as we have in this area, to really protect your waterways and your fisheries. And you also do a number of workshops for people around a lot of these issues. I'd love to start out today by having you tell our listeners about the workshops that you offer, what they entail, and what you hope that participants in those workshops will be able to accomplish once they've completed the workshop with you to go out and continue to do this work that you're so valiantly doing yourself.
All right. Yes, I give Idle No More workshops. I have a series of them that I've been giving to our friends and allies. I talk about the history of colonization and regarding Native people and talk about how this has continued to this day. I talk about the history of our genocide, colonization, and the legislative, how that was indoctrinated into our, against our people, including our Indian Removal Act, boarding schools, every facet of our life that was impacted. And so then I with that, I also bring people into awareness about what happened to the colonizers. And there was a Native American filmmaker here. He was like one of the first filmmakers back in the 70s, Phil Lucas, and He did great documentaries about Native people and colonization. And I used to go to his film festivals, and during one of his question and answer periods, I asked him, well, what happened to the colonizers? He says the colonizers have become colonized. So I tie that into how what has happened to us was brought over here and happened thousands of years before what we now know as a Western and colonization. It has continued, and even to this day. So I tried that in and asked people to think about how the system of governance has continued. And I let them talk about within themselves how this is impacting our lives today, not just Native Americans, but everybody. Then I also talk about the history of the healing from historical trauma and how colonization has impacted our Native people. And so I bring into that and give much of my own history too in this, how, you know, every aspect of colonization, and I give examples of how that has impacted my own family and people.
Sweetwater, why do you feel it's so important for not just the Native tribes, but also for the colonizers, the broader and larger U.S. population and North America and South America as well, but I'm thinking about my own country, the United States. Why do you think it's so important for them to understand not just that they have been colonizers, but that they are being colonized? And what does that mean? What does it mean that we're colonized, and by whom?
It's a lot of it is from the still continue through the government and those really running our countries today, including the corporations now. I call it the corporate colonization that has continued. And it's important for them to know that we're all in this together, really. And together we need to decolonize in order to work together at this crucial time in our history as the earth is changing, and that it takes all of us. I mean, there's indigenous prophecies that the people would come together, you know, at this time. And in order to do that, we also need to heal together too. So that's why I think it's important to learn about our history, who we are, where we come from, in order to do our own individual healing, because the earth is just a reflection of us. You know, the earth is sick, so, and we as a people are sick also. In order to heal, we need to take those steps. And it's not an easy process. And so I help my people through that step by step to address their own healing, historical trauma, you know, historical oppression too. So I give examples of, well, maybe their ancestors, like, came, you know, I'm in Washington State, say they came here from the East Coast a couple hundred years ago and they cut down all the trees. They've also benefited, and their ancestors may have contributed to this too. So sometimes there's healing about that needs to take place. But the key to recovery is in restoring our original instructions. And that's why so much of our learning our own culture is important. And I stress that too, not just as a Native Indigenous, but all people, because becoming colonized, that they've left their ancestors behind. They've lost much of their traditional ways and languages. And so that's part of the healing process.
I do a lot of this type of work myself. I do a lot of workshops on conquest and colonialism. In fact, I'm going to be teaching a course on Wednesday at the University of Maine's Diversity Leadership Institute on that very topic. And one of the things that I also focus on is this understanding that we've all been deeply impacted by this deep psychic spiritual wound that overlays the land, and that we all carry historical trauma because the acts that were committed on this land are not natural acts for human beings to commit against one another, that it's a violation of our spirit. And we're going to be holding a big healing ceremony here in June of 2017, because, as you said, our prophecies talk about this, and they talk about first contact happening here in the Eastern Gate, and about the healing needs to also start addressing that really deep psychic and spiritual wound from that same location. And I think it's vitally important for people to understand, because as you know, and as I know, and anyone that's doing this work knows, that when these issues emerge, such as the modern day issues that we're talking about now, which really are continued examples of colonialism and genocide, ecological genocide, and, you know, this corporate colonization that's taking place, that as we move to address these issues, to understand how we're all impacted by them, the project to prison pipelines that's been created for the Black population, where it's larger in scope than slavery ever dreamed of being, and the missing and murdered Indigenous women, the taking of our children from our families that's happening all over the world for Indigenous people. All of these things are just modern day examples of continued genocide and colonization. And to understand that both sides are impacted by that, both those who are the perpetrators and those who are the alleged victims of those crimes are impacted by that in a deep spiritual way. And the only way that we can address that is to go back to our original instructions. And one of the things I teach about, which you'll appreciate given your clan system, is that our first agreement here was with the whales, that we say that our original treaty was with the Creator to live in harmonious balance with this land. But then the next treaty that we made was our treaty with the whales, to make sure that they were provided a safe, dignified, balanced, harmonious life within their waterways, and that we wouldn't disrupt that. And so when we go back and we start talking about original instructions, I would love to hear the story of what those original instructions are for your people and how they come into play in the work that you're doing.
Well, a lot of our original instructions are passed down through our ancestors, of living and honoring each other, honoring our elders, our children, our people. I come from a very strong matriarchal society and was raised by very strong grandmothers. And then in our relationship with the land, it's a spiritual and strong connection. As I introduced myself, I was telling you my mother's side. As I said, I'm from the Killiwell clan. I told you my mother is from the Killiwell clan. I honor my father's side. When I introduce myself this way to the elders when I'm in Alaska, they know exactly where I come from. And telling you that I came from the Stikine River, we have stories about that. Even our migrations from Canada up along the coastline and down under a glacier, and how we became, you know, how my ancestors became the Upper Living People clan, because we came down, we were going up to Alaska. And there were several migrations. There wasn't just one. And this is thousands of years ago, before the Great Flood. So we have a story about that, how we came down the glacier led by these two elderly women, U'ushtafti and Kawasif. And they volunteered to go under the glacier to find a way for us. And they came back, and our people went under the glacier and continued down the Stikine River. And there was my previous migration of the Kiksabi clan, my father's people. And they were originally, our people used to be river people, so they had their longhouse up there by the river. And then the Wolf clan continued on down the river, and they split up. And one stayed farther up the river and became known as the Nanyai, the Upper Living People clan. The other one went farther down the river and they made their house out by the outer sands, and it became known as the Daksawedi, the outer sands people. And so we kept these names so we know what our connection to those lands, and not only that, our clan ties to one another. So when I introduce myself, someone from the Daksawedi clan will know who my ancestors were and our connections and our ties with each and with one another. And we, in our Tlingit society, we had a moiety, which is two, the clan divided into two. And that was the Wolf clan and the Raven clan. And we lived in a balance with each other. So what that meant was we married our opposite clan, because it was against our laws to marry someone from the same clan. That would be like marrying your brother or sister. And so we had strict society structures around that. But we also helped each other. Say if my the Raven Clan was in need of a new canoe or a new longhouse, they would ask the opposite clan to do the work, and they would do that work for us. And then we would have a ceremony, a potlatch, and dedicate that new canoe or the new house and give it a name and honor it because it has a spirit also. And then we would pay our opposite clan for the work that they have done and have a feast and a giveaway. And so that was, that kept our life in balance, how we helped each other and we needed each other and honored each other. So that was some of our original instructions. And we still have this system today too of working together and helping each other with our community to keep us strong in our cultural, in our language, making regalia.
Sweetwater, while you were speaking of your families, well, many branches of it, traditions and ways that they interrelate, it reminds me a little bit of the work that's being done in some of the resilience communities or the resilience movement to take the culture at large, the U.S. culture, and really challenge some of the assumptions. Maybe some of these are what you might describe as colonized behaviors of isolation, automization, and everyone has their own lawnmower, everyone has their own this, that, and the other thing. And they're becoming very lonely and isolated. And we've just seen an escalation of this through consumerism and consumption. And it has negative effects for not just the environment, but also for our communities. And so some of the ways that people are approaching this is to challenge those behaviors. And they're finding, to their surprise, that it's also a direct challenge to capitalism and to the economic system that has demonstrated itself to be so destructive in so many ways. My question for you is that at this time of the climate crisis, and actually this week as we're recording, there's many people rising up all around the world to protest the use of fossil fuels and to blockade and stop the coal plants and the oil trains and the pipelines. It's just going on all over the world. What can you share with us in terms of your own perspective of the work that needs to be done to actually move back into a harmonious relationship with the earth in this time of climate crisis?
Well, this leads to my next workshop is spiritual activism. So I consider myself a spiritual warrior and do much of my work through prayer and ceremony. And so that's for the work that I do, that's the most important part, and that lays a foundation for the rest of the work that needs to be done to address these important issues today. For instance, the Arctic, as I shared previously, I was doing prayers and ceremonies, you know, here in Seattle, in Washington, D.C., up in Alaska, when President Obama was up there for that Glacier Conference, we went up there. And that is the work, and that's some of the work I stress, is that the spiritual work needs to be done. And yeah, there's gonna the protests and blockades. Yeah, that's some big work. But when it's coming from a different place, from the mind or maybe the ego, instead of from the spirit and from the heart, it's not bringing about the change that needs to happen. It's not bringing about that spiritual, the shift that needs to happen. And so that's what the difference is in the way Indigenous and Native people do our activism. You see many of the people out there doing the prayers and the ceremonies, even Idle No More. I remember when it first started with the singing and the prayers just in the malls all over the place. They've done them here too. And I said, they're praying. Those are prayer songs. They're calling our ancestors. And that's the work that needs to happen. But in order to do that, too, we also need to work on ourselves and bring about the healing. So it's healing ourselves and the earth at the same time. I mean, even with this great victory we had here in Washington with the Great Lenni Nation in the victory over stopping the coal, proposed coal terminal, I had a dream about it the night before on Sunday. I dreamt I was in this big field surrounded by trees, and there was a lot of people in the field, and they were talking. They're talking about our enemies and their tactics and their strategies. And I walked up through the crowd up to the front and got up and spoke. And I said, I told them, I fought them before and I beat them. We can do this. I told them that it wasn't not just me, but it was to all of us. And that's what I was seeing. And then that same night on that Monday, a friend of mine also had a dream. And she said she'd seen hundreds of killer whales. They were in warrior mode, in fight mode. And they're driving out these, and they're going through murky and dark waters to drive out these intruders. And to me, we were seeing things spiritually that was taking place before it happened in our, you know, our physical world, as most people are only aware of a lot of times of that.
That's absolutely right. And this work can't be done just in the physical because the scope of it is so big that we need to have that spiritual piece of it brought into play because it's the most powerful tool that we have. It's the most powerful resource that we have is our prayers. All of the work that we've done here in the Northeast is always initiated, carried through, and then ended with prayer. And there was some activity that was going on up in New Brunswick last year, and we had a number of women and a number of men, all pipe carriers, who offered to do pipe ceremony at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. every single day. And they did that for 3 months. And what ended up happening was they were praying for the healing of the hearts and the minds of the people that were making these decisions. Very subtle things started to shift. The people who were in these decision-making positions suddenly quit their jobs and said that they could no longer do this work. And it created all of this disruption within the system. And those prayers and that ceremony is so powerful because we are connecting to that web of creation, that we're actually going right into that matrix of life and being able to shift the energy that is attached to these things. Because really what we're dealing with when we're dealing with these things is mental and spiritual illness. That people have become lost. They've forgotten their connection to all of creation and their connection to other human beings and all life, and that those prayers can help reconnect those lost connections so that people can be reminded about where they come from, what they're connected to, who their kin are. You know, and we end our prayers always with Ndil Nabamuk, which reminds us that we're all related. We're all connected. We can't pray for anything for ourselves without it impacting others. Recognizing those connections and being able to tap into that as we do this work is really fundamental to what we're doing. One of the things that I teach in my workshop is this, one of the words for warrior. We don't have any words for warrior that indicate violence. They're all about protection of the people. It's about service to the people. For instance, one of our words for warrior is Ginup, which means the protector. Another word is Zamognus, which means being able to come forward and to use enough force to hold back the tide of harm that's coming towards you without harming the other. And so when we start thinking about this work and we think about it in relation to love and revolution, this idea of embattlement, of conquering and overthrowing, these are really conquest ideologies that have been embedded into the psyche of the human mind for centuries. And it's part of that pattern that we're trying to move beyond, we're trying to overcome. And so when we engage this work, being able to engage it in a way that stops the flow of harm, but also recognizes the value of life and the importance of not violating that life, to try to reach collaborative, cooperative agreements, I guess, or movement that actually allows people the ability to shift, allows them the opportunity to heal their mind and spirit, to reconnect with the elements of creation. Do you have practices like that within your tradition that talk about being able to come forward and to protect and to serve while still valuing life, because we're also a matriarchal society. So we operate from a system of clan mothers who are given the opportunity to look at every problem that comes, find a solution that honors life, that nurtures life, that protects life and sustains life. And then they give the orders to the hereditary chiefs and warriors. Okay, now we've figured out how we're going to solve this problem. Now you go out and go forward and put this plan into action. What is the structure of your matriarchal society and the structure of your warrior societies that you bring to play in the work that you do?
Yes, speaking from a blanket side of my family, our women had a lot of power in our culture. And long ago, the men used to have to come and ask the women's permission to go to war. And if they said no, they didn't go. The women had a lot of power in even our trading. And when the colonizers first came, they were surprised at how much power our women had, that a man couldn't even trade without his wife's permission. And I know things have changed a lot, too, because of colonization. It seems to have switched towards more of a patriarchal model that, you know, is at odds with our original teachings. But we still honor the woman's side of the family, our clan side. But I see a lot today, a lot of our women, not just from within my tribe, but all over the world, really, that are stepping up and taking in leadership positions to help bring about a lot of the changes that are now happening in our activism that is going on. And I do believe we're in that time that was prophesized, that our indigenous people and our women would step up. And that's been a little hard, too, dealing with through the Western culture. It's more patriarchy many times. I've had challenges working with non-natives because of that, because of being a woman, that I may not have carry as much respect, or they think I don't deserve enough of that respect as a male, say, if it was, they look towards a male for leadership. So it's been an educational process, too, that I've been having to help with the people, participants in my workshop. And so the spiritual part also is very important. And our warriors, we have in our society, they have their role too. Just like you say, we didn't call them warriors. They were our protectors. And our women also played a part in that also. Our Tlingit women, they would be one at the head of our canoe when we did go to war. And there's a whole ceremony about that, going to war and coming back. And we had peace ceremonies also too. And I've talked to some elders about this, about doing peace ceremonies. And because I have some incidents within my own family, too, because within our clan system, we had longtime enemies, even within the Tlingit people. And a lot of times we had peace ceremonies with one another. And I like to share that when I give talk stories to youth, that there was a process about it, that when we decided we would have peace, we would bring four men from each side. We would exchange them, and they would tie a hand behind their back. That the ones we were making peace with, they would have to take care of them, feed them, do everything for them until they had the ceremony. And they were called the Guakan. They were deer, because deer are peaceful creatures. They represented that. And I asked children, how many people have you and your family that have been in the military? Usually they all raise their hand. I said, can you imagine bringing some enemies into your home and taking care of them? And even they have killed your brother or your uncle or your father or your grandfather. And making peace, that is how we do it. So it's important. I really feel bringing back our culture is very strong in this work. And I try to do it in a way that, you know, and I let our friends and allies know not to appropriate our culture or to copy it, because I've faced some of that too. So that's been challenging also. And let people know that, let the Native people take the lead. Take their lead, take the lead in this organizing. And that's one thing I really want to stress too with this work, is why are we not having a call of action that is Native Indigenous led? Why are we waiting for our allies to have their annuals, the next big protest or blockade? Why are they not just supporting a Native initiative that would be nationwide? So those are some of the questions. And I realize that not everybody is at that level either, that our allies and friends. And that's why they need to learn about this, learn for themselves, their healing, and how to respect. And we have to reteach and relearn who we are in our connection and honor to the earth.
And we'll be back after a quick break for Station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. This week in our Nonviolence Minute, we're going to pick up one of the ideas Sweetwater Nanak has been mentioning and explore it even further. Spirituality and nonviolent activism have a long history together. And since Sweetwater and Sherry are both offering examples of how they have experienced the interweaving of the two within their Indigenous and Native traditions and organizing, let's look at some other historical examples. Let's start with Gandhi, who was Hindu, but also advocated for Hindu-Muslim unity and tolerance of all faiths. Many of the key concepts woven throughout the Indian self-rule movement come from a faith-based perspective, drawing on Sanskrit words and concepts. Gandhi advocated meditation as well as bread labor, constructive action, and engaging in what he called satyagraha, or direct action. Gandhi's Pashtun counterpart, Bacha Khan, was a Muslim. He organized a 100,000-person peace army that was called Servants of God. They built schools and organized campaigns in close concert with Gandhi's work. This was in the region that is now known as Pakistan. Speaking of Islam, in 2009 in Iran during the Green Revolution, people went onto their rooftops to shout Allah Akbar, God is great, as part of the protest against the regime. In response, the regime had two choices. One, let the protest grow, which was not a very attractive option to them, or two, arrest people for shouting that God is great, something very commonly done by devout Muslims. This is a classic example of a dilemma action, a nonviolent action that puts the opposition between a rock and a hard place. U.S.-based clergy, for example, created similar challenges during the Ferguson and Baltimore uprisings, kneeling at the front lines of the struggle to pray, and forcing the police to arrest, on mass media, praying faith leaders. One of the most stunning examples of spiritual activism emerged with the People Power Revolution in the Philippines, which ended the rule of the U.S.-backed dictator Ferdinand Marcos. The Catholic Church, particularly Cardinal Sin, sponsored a series of nonviolent trainings through the Fellowship of Reconciliation. He and other church leaders issued numerous sermons, memos, letters to clergy and laypeople, urging them to join the nonviolent movement that was growing to support Corazon Aquino as a presidential candidate. In the final tumultuous days of the conflict, when the defense minister defected from the Marcos regime and took along with him 200 to 400 troops, Cardinal Sin visited four orders of nuns and instructed them to pray and fast. The heat of the battle was on. He then got on the radio and called for all children of God to go to where the rebel troops were and to protect them nonviolently, stopping an emerging civil war or a massacre. As Marcos' soldiers started to come closer to where the rebel soldiers were, 40,000 people answered the call that Cardinal Sin had put out. Priests and nuns placed crosses in the road and knelt in front of tanks to stop them. They prayed for the soldiers to refrain from violence. And when gunshots did break out, a lone priest stood on the back of a truck, which inched slowly between the warring factions, and prayed the rosary and sang Ave Maria. Stunned onlookers joined in, and the soldiers stopped shooting. In combination with many other types of nonviolent actions, these events were pivotal to the successful conclusion of the People Power Revolution. The stories of faith in action and spiritual activism are uncountable, from Thich Nhat Hanh's peace work with the engaged Buddhists to the Nevada Desert Experience's masses in protest of nuclear bomb testing, to the spirituals and sermons of Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement. There are countless stories from around the world about the importance of putting our prayers into action and praying with our feet that demonstrate how spirituality and social change go hand in hand. Know your nonviolent history. It might change your life. This week's featured music is by Aircab. You can find this and other tracks on Jamendo.com. And now let's return to our conversation with Sweetwater Nanak. You know, Sweetwater, I think that's one of the reasons why we wanted to invite you on the show and share some of your thoughts and insights is because there are many people who don't even know what they don't know, and then there's people who don't even know how to start dealing with what they're starting to learn, and that we're all in a process of learning and educating. And I know Sherry and I have had several conversations about this along the way, and she can comment about some of her shared experiences of what you just described. When you were speaking earlier, you reminded me that on Occupy Radio, you told us, you said, we're praying that Arctic oil rig, the Shell Arctic rig, is not going to stay in Alaska. It may get there, but it's not going to stay there. And sure enough, months later, you're proved completely right about that. And in a very unexpected way, nobody knew that the battle would take place, you know, in Portland, or that the rig would start going up the coast and get turned back. But now actually Shell has withdrawn from the Arctic and is giving up on millions of dollars of oil leases that they have. And I just wanted to bring up that story as a powerful testimony to what you're saying. We don't need proof for us to believe in the power of prayer, but it certainly helps those who are skeptic among us. And I think one of the things that you're reminding me is that those of us who have an uncomfortable relationship with prayer, for many people, you know, prayer and spirituality coming through a particular church or faith perspective has not been a healing experience. But we have a bad habit of turning our back on the entire spiritual dimension because of those bad experiences, instead of deepening and questioning and probing and finding our way back to home. Because the dimension of the spirit is a dimension for me of being human. I think also one of the other things that was very insightful for me that you just brought up was the art of waging peace. And Sherry mentioned a little bit about the warrior and the role of a whole society in studying not only how do we wage war, but also how do we make peace afterwards. And I feel like that's something that from the U.S. military to U.S. movements for change, we really are kind of missing the mark on. We're very colonized around violence and war and conflict. And even our movements for change often are very much steeped in this attitude of we're going to beat and conquer and trample their heads into the ground. And you can see it online in social forums. You can see it in the rhetoric of movements. What kind of thoughts or insights might you have to share on this and how we can transform that in our movements for change?
Well, part of it is, I think, is learning a different way of doing things. And I think a lot of people are hungry for this. They just don't know how to do that. And because we're seeing more of it, I mean, even after when Shell came out, I remember stories coming out. The non-natives would say, we did it, we did it, we fought, we won. And when I would see natives articles or write-ups or posting about it, they were thanking the creator, thanking the ancestors, thanking that our prayers were answered. It's like we didn't take the credit for it because we didn't do it. We had to do the prayers. We did our part in those prayers, and the ancestors came and they were answered. But it's just interesting the perspective. And so it is hard because a lot of times what I see in the movement is people who do not have a spiritual foundation. Maybe they're atheist and don't believe in what we're doing either. When I first started doing this work, I was being tokenized, which is kind of pretty common in this activist world. As long as I was going along with that, they were reaching out to me and, oh, let's go do this protest or blockade. But once I decided, no, that's not actually making a big of a difference or impact, I decided I'm going to do the spiritual work, that they devalue, have no value for what I'm doing. And I'm no longer invited to those kind of activities. And that's okay too. So I feel like everybody just needs to do their part. And that's a part of the healing too. And I feel like with the work I'm doing, I just need to reach, and I pray about everything. I just need to pray and reach the right people I'm supposed to be meeting up with, talking to, and sharing. And that not everybody will get it, at least not at this time. But if there's enough of us, our prayers will make that difference. And that's what it was. In each instance, when I was doing the prayers, say for a show in D.C. or in Seattle, up in Alaska, it wasn't thousands of people, a few hundreds. And I would pray about that the right people would be there, that we're all in one mind, body, and spirit, and sending those prayers out and having no doubt whatsoever. And that's what it was, having no doubt at all that our prayers would be answered.
I think that's really beautiful because we often get so caught up in what's going on here in front of our eyes that we forget what our powers are as co-creators of our own reality. And to be able to tap into that and to recognize that we do have the ability to be able to create change here in the physical reality that we're experiencing, and that we do that by tapping into that invisible realm. And I think one of the things that I found hopeful in what you're talking about in my own experience has been that there are a lot of people who don't believe in prayer, who have no use for any type of spiritual way of being. And as has been the case with so many things, science is starting to catch up with what we've always known as Indigenous people. And what people can now connect with in some ways, even if they can't connect with the spiritual aspects of this and don't have that depth of understanding and personal experience with that, is that they're part of a larger energetic vibration, that their energy that they're contributing is part of this larger energetic pattern that's actually forming our reality. And physics is catching up with that and is saying, oh, look at this. And, you know, Indigenous people are saying, ah, yes, we've known about that for a very long time. And as the science starts to catch up with what we know, people are starting to open their eyes to a greater degree and to understand not only are they awakening in regard to the harm that's being done to their ability to sustain life on this planet, but they're also awakening to these deeper connections that we all have. I think that we could all spend days talking about these types of things, and this is directly in my wheelhouse. This is where I would like to stay all the time if I could. But I really want to bring some attention to some of the issues that you are working on right now. And I'd like to kind of switch gears a little bit and have you tell us about some of the issues, the specific issues that you're working on right now, and how people might be able to come forward and to assist with some of those issues that you're facing and dealing with right now in your region.
Well, some of the work I'm doing will be to help with our Native youth. And I'll be doing Native youth action camps this summer. Last summer I spent in reaching out to other Native youth organizations who are already doing the work that we can partner with together. You know, I don't like to call us activists because it's just our language, it's our Thinkit Kusti, our Thinkit way of life. I'm just doing what I'm supposed to be doing. part of the work is I'm reaching out to much younger Native people in their 20s who are already working with Native youth in order to prepare the next generations for the work that we're starting today. And so that's really important for us, that the work will continue. It's always going to be there. But if we're in these spiritual foundations, these works now, and doing the healing work for ourselves and for our youth, because it's not just about the environment, as we've talked about, it's about healing ourselves and healing from that historical trauma in order to be stronger, that we can fulfill our purpose and our mission that we've all come together at this time to do. So some of that work will be happening here in Washington State. It's important to address some of the problems that we're facing now. Well, actually, I should acknowledge first our victories, too, because you may have heard on May 9th, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied the permit for the proposed Gateway Pacific Terminal here in on the Great Lummi Nation, that is near Bellingham. And that's a major victory for them, and they're exerting and standing up for their treaty rights. And so it's for a win. For them is a win for all of us, and that was really important. So I would really love to see non-Natives to help support our Native people. I know a lot of times our Native people here, they don't go out and do protests and blockades and all that. They're actually, the work they're being done is coming from in a different way. And standing up for the treaty rights was a major force that helped bring about this great and awesome change that benefits all of us here in the state of Washington. So on the other hand, with that here, because of the climate change and droughts we've had here last year, we're having problems with the salmon too. So they closed salmon last year, the coho season, and they're closing it again this year. But the local tribes were allowed to go and do some of their fishing for subsistence and for their first salmon ceremonies. But that brought about a lot of backlash from the non-natives in very awful, hurtful way, which is coming from non-natives, fishermen, commercial fishers, sports fishermen. So I want to see how more of our non-natives can stand with our native people at these times. You know, there was this big action we were talking about this weekend of the Break Free. But are those people standing up for our people when we're facing this opposition, that they're saying they want to shoot at the boats, that they're threatening violence at our people, to sink their nets, to why don't we give them some smallpox blankets? Just really ugly things. We need those allies to stand with us at those times too. You know, a lot of the work I've done environmental, I've also, when Native people in our communities need help for preserving and keeping our Indian Heritage Program at Seattle Public Schools, or saving the murals. Where were all those allies then? We need them through when we're struggling too, through our struggles. It's not just the environment, it's our way of life. And so this is the difference, I guess, that our allies would need to learn about. For us, it's our way of life. And it's not just now, but it's been this way thousands of years. So I teach a lot about that with my workshops and how to work with natives better in a good way. And some of that is, you know, I'm just talking about the differences in organizing and our communication styles. As I said, it's a place-based rather than a linear temporal focus. It's like as I told you where I was from, you know, when we come to our doing some of the work, it's whose land is it on? What ceremony will honor this place and the original people, and how to work together to support the original stewards of this land. So I talk about what I call colonial moments, and I also address that and bring that to light. And a lot of it, well, everything I share is in my own experience in working with our allies, from not listening to speaking for us, to tokenizing, and these things that are really hurtful and not actually bringing about the needed change that we need to work together in a good way. And I talk about colonial interventions and how to address these issues at the time and bring about healing and healing for us too.
Thank you for sharing all of that, Sweetwater, the victories and the challenges and just some of the territory of work that can be done that lies ahead of us still. I know for me it was a very deep reflection to really listen deeply to that and question, where am I doing these behaviors and where can I change? And I think that's one of the benefits of you getting out and doing your workshops, is you provide a space for people to learn and grow and shift their behaviors. And that's the healing work that also needs to happen. What might be a good place for any of our listeners to start if they're curious about how they can be a better ally or where they can learn more about this? Where should they direct their attention and start this journey?
Well, I always encourage people to learn about themselves and their ancestors. And they have come from somewhere. In one of my workshops, I lead people through a meditation and doing the healing historical trauma. And if they see and know, and they hadn't even considered maybe before, that hundreds of years ago, they were indigenous people too, that were also colonized, whether it was by Romans or other, you know, England or other tribes, to first learn about themselves and then learn about the native people too. I know there's many native events that happen also in which you can go, you know, they can participate in. Like I go on the annual canoe journey, we always need volunteers for that every year. I usually volunteer in the healing tent. So I know, you know, a lot of tribes will have a thank you dinner, and there's usually like up to a couple thousand people, volunteers for this, because it's a huge event. In fact, the workshops I'll be doing, I'll be partnering with other people of color. And when I do my series, and then also help recommend or place them to in these volunteer events, a Native event that they probably would never hear about or be invited to or to participate somehow. So there's ways to learn about the history of the land, of the Native people, and even that of, as even after that, I was talking to a friend of mine who's African American, and he was telling me the history of the first African Americans here in Seattle. And I've looked into the history of the Chinese, for example. So I think learning about the history, because that's important about what's happening now, is in a Native way, the past, present, and future are all connected. And we can, by doing the healing work and knowing what's happened in the past, we can help change that and shift that. So I invite people to also go to my Facebook page, Idle No More Washington, so you can follow me there, because I will be, you know, I travel to different places to do workshops. Again, San Francisco, I'm going up to Alaska this week. And I do believe from the one in San Francisco, I'll be invited out to Toronto and Portland and other places too. So, but the page is a good place to find out where I'll be traveling.
I'd like to remind our listeners that we have the pleasure and the honor of speaking with and learning from Sweetwater Nanook, who is the director of Idle No More Washington. And Sweetwater, I would like to say to you, Kachiwaliwan Nitabesk, you know, thank you, heartfelt thanks to you, sister, and Kasalamul, lots of love to you and the work that you're doing. I honor you and I honor your contributions and your spirit. And thank you for being here in this world at this time of great need. We need you. And we're thankful, very thankful that you're here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the good work that you both are doing, and it gives me hope for our future. Thank you so much.
I need you to feel love right now. I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest, Sweetwater Nanook, and to my co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is also performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to my wonderful co-host, Sherry Mitchell, whom it's so wonderful to have back on the show this week. You can follow her great insights and writings at her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. If you're looking for that link, it's in our show notes and on our Podomatic page. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it if you take a moment and go and ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. Sweetwater Nanook gave us a lot of things to think about regarding the deep spirituality that is often attached to our paths. She encouraged us to think about a number of things, including how we can support those who are engaged in protective and sustainable practices. Sweetwater also encouraged us to learn more about ourselves and to learn about the Native people that are in your region. Perhaps you'll take the time to honor those suggestions by the time we talk to you next week. What if you knew?